This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
A very good morning to all of you. Welcome to the Morning Run. I'm Julian Ng, and with me is Sharad Kutin, as usual. We've got a really great lineup for you today. And on the breakfast grill, we're going to have Martin Krutner, who's the Dean of the International Anti-Corruption Academy. And Sharad, you're going to speak to him.
Yeah, so because today is International Anti-Corruption Day, so, you know, and therefore a discussion on efforts to battle corruption, seemed logical to have. In fact, currently underway is the 17th International Anti-Corruption Conference, called the IACC, and that's happening in, of all places, Panama. Which seems to be a perfect
irony.
Well, of course, that was called tax avoidance by some. Some people call it tax evasion. And it depends, I think, on your laws, how clearly they define.
It depends on how clear your mind is after having gone through the, page 1,250 of the Panama Papers.
Yeah. So today at our disposal, at the disposal of anti-corruption agencies, in fact, is this capacity to cut through all the opacity of of the paper trail, right, that maybe hides and lurks behind all these transactions and transfers of money, and to ferret out real details about tax evasion. So I think it's an extraordinary time if there is political will, and I think that at the end of the day really is what the discussion is about. Is there political will, even by governments that claim to be against corruption? I mean, it's one of those bandwagons, isn't it? Everybody has gone green, no matter what toxic stuff they're pouring onto planet Earth. They've all gone green.
They've embraced it into their ecosystem.
Right. So now everybody's against corruption because, of course, it's a vote winner in democratic societies. But are you truly interested in combating corruption? Not just the small, the small fish, as it were, but the big numbers. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really where it's at in terms of the fight against corruption. And I look forward to the grill. That's at 8 o'clock.
We don't know a lot about this IACC. What is the background and who sets it up?
I actually am not so clear about the IACC myself. But what did go around, and I think on WhatsApp groups, was a little video clip of Claire Ruth Castle-Brown from the Stroud Report speaking to a camera about and addressing, in fact, the Deputy Prime Minister, because she was singled out in at the UMNO General Assembly. Sorry, and Claire Rucastle Brown says, "Well, okay, so we exposed some of these details. It's since been corroborated by a number of agencies, including the FBI. Why not go after them? Why go after me?" She says, and, that's a fascinating video, and it's making its rounds. So
she also, I saw a little bit of it, and she also extended an invitation to the Deputy Prime Minister, saying that there is no need to hunt for her. She's there.
Come and have tea. Because he was there, remember, in Britain for quite a substantial amount of time, also inaugurating a new, I think, a Center of Islamic Studies or something that the Malaysian government had endowed for a fabulous sum. So millions of pounds of Malaysian taxpayers' money went into refurbishing a building in Britain. That, of course, raised the ire of some local student activists who pointed out, perhaps the contradiction. On one hand, the government cutting down on subsidies to universities, going after students in terms of loans and stuff. At the same time, kind of extravagantly funding projects overseas, prestige projects, some would say, overseas.
Yeah, I think that's very ironic. And also, I think 2016 would, for me personally, be remembered as a year where, going back to the topic of corruption, where the idea of corporate corruption had been highlighted, by the likes of Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, even Donald Trump, who at the time promised to sever those ties with the Wall Street cozies. But we know that's not true now. But the point is that we have always been focusing on government and political corruption and this idea of corporate corruption, even in its most seemingly innocuous forms, seem to have been highlighted in 2016 with the Panama Papers, with the fact that so many tech companies in the United States hide away their profits in offshore centers, and you know, this revolving door between government officials and corporate officials. And the way they dish out contracts, you know, that's all coming to the fore in 2016. And I'm really looking forward to this grill.
Yeah, you know, talking about 2016 and Hillary Clinton, I mean, that race did you know, force me to read up on things American, including the Clinton Foundation. And, you know, and the kind of influence peddling that seems to happen. I mean, you know, Donald Trump today has a lot of big decisions to make about ring fencing
his own interests,
his business interests, which are global, in order to make sure that policy isn't about enriching himself or his cronies. But Clinton herself, as when she was Secretary of State, Bill Clinton, her husband, made $47 million U.S. dollars in lecture fees. I mean, is he that brilliant a speaker? Or is this about people finding ways of influencing the Secretary of State, through something like the Clinton Foundation? So these were accusations. And this is why Hillary was a terrible candidate for the Democrats. Yes, she was a woman, but boy, was she somebody so you know, up to her double chin in you know, this kind of coziness between business and politics.
Yeah, and there's this thing called the blind trust, which I found very interesting. Of course, it's not a new concept. It's been used by many politicians of the past before. But essentially what it is that you hand over the management of the business to a trust, a bunch of trustees, and you should have no influence over them, used by many politicians. I mean, a lot of these creative ways on how you can maintain ownership without while severing your influence, right? So to me, it's more like a fight between good and evil, you know, like,
oh my goodness,
like Star Wars,
well,
you know, the dark side.
Well, you find Mr. Kreutner coming on at 8 o'clock much more nuanced in his message. You know, in fact, he's against this idea of thinking of the fight against corruption as one of good versus evil.
Oh,
but we'll come to that at 8 o'clock.
Okay, so current affairs is happening as well, and today we're looking at the Orang Asli, especially the blockade in Kelantan that's been making the headlines. What's this all about, Shrat?
Well, you know, so there we've had the media spectacle has been on the blockade, but because blockades in Kelantan go back for some time now because of attempts to grab land from the Orang Asli. This particular one seemed to have grabbed the attention of the media. The media sometimes ignores the Orang Asli and its concerns.
That's corruption too, I think.
Well, that, yeah, I mean, for me, that's not exactly corruption, but that's certainly a failure of imagination and a failure to recognize that even tiny little populations, tiny communities that have absolutely no influence are still important because they tell us something about how larger society is operating. So at any rate, there was a mass arrest of community leaders. About 40, over 40 people were, you know, arrested. And so this particular blockade and this community have been taken up as a cause celeb by activists in the Klang Valley and such. So we're looking at this story, giving some background and framing it. And of course, it's perfect for World Human Rights Day, which is tomorrow. So tomorrow we celebrate World Human Rights Day. Today we celebrate the fight against corruption.
That's interesting. I think they go hand in hand, right? Because corruption has an effect on the deterioration of human rights all over the world.
Absolutely.
Okay, let's do a quick catch-up on the news.
But yeah. Julian, remember, there is the property show at 9:30. We don't have details of it, but remember, and we'll get details very soon.
Okay. From the Earth, we go to outer space, where an astronaut has died, and this is a guy named John Glenn,
yeah,
who's also a senator.
Yeah, he became a senator after his career as an astronaut, but he was the first American to orbit the Earth. And we have a very interesting story written in the New York Times, and we could tweet that out for you if you are interested in his particular story. He died at the age, he was in his 90s actually, when he died, which was yesterday, I believe. And so, he was not the first person, not first human being to orbit the Earth. The first goes to the Russian Yuri Gagarin, who orbited the Earth in 1961, a year before John Glenn did. It's kind of breaking news, partly because this is a man who represents a particular history, a real turning point in our relationship to outer space.
Mm-hmm. And was that at the start of the Cold War between Russia and America? Absolutely. And they were having this race to go to outer space.
Absolutely. Of course, before human beings went to outer space, I believe they were animals. I think they sent a dog and a monkey. And of course, a woman also went into space. So a human being, but, that half of the species that often doesn't get recognized. The Cold War had a lot of unintended consequences because of the competition between these two huge blocs, the so-called free world and the so-called not free world, the Soviet Union, the communist world. And very, very interesting stories. We're still living out some of the legacy, I think, of the Cold War. If Trump, we don't know if Trump is going to create a third world war, a new Cold War. In fact, people have been suggesting that even under Obama, there has been, in fact, a ratcheting up of tensions along the old fault lines, and so there is a kind of new Cold War.
But Donald Trump is going to fix that, isn't
he? Because he likes Putin, and Putin likes him.
So hopefully that bromance will benefit the rest of the world. Another person dies, unfortunately, and this one is in Pakistan, where this pop star turned preacher who was in an air crash.
Yeah, remember, this is the air crash from 2 days ago, and there are, of course, air crashes around the world. And for me, when I read that kind of news, Julian, I just think, oh, okay. They don't mention anybody famous. I think, who knows? They're just ordinary Pakistanis. But apparently, one of them was a very important person in sort of Pakistani history, and his name is Junaid Jamshed, and he, kind of represented the face of kind of Western pop music. He was in a band called Vital Signs, but somewhere in his life, it turned and he became quite religious and became a preacher. And so when he died just a couple of days ago in his early 50s, he was really well known for becoming a preacher. And we can think of other pop stars turned preachers like Cat Stevens. Who became Yusuf Islam. And, and there are, of course, pop stars who go on to do other things.
Love that song, Morning Has Broken.
Well, there you have it. I don't know about Junaid Jamshed, what Vital Signs. I don't think we have it on our playlist, but that's there. Some rock stars never change. Mick Jagger has become a father again at the age of 73 with his girlfriend, who's age 29. So that you do the math, Julian. The difference between those two.
Not quite cradles snatching, but
44 years.
A big enough age gap, because you can't call a 29-year-old still being in her cradle, right?
No, she's not. I mean, she's not a child, but the gap is extraordinary. Perhaps something the public will applaud if you're a rock star. She's a ballerina, by the way. And she gave birth to a baby boy. So Mick Jagger already has 7 children with ages ranging from 17 to 45.
Yeah, and he probably has grandchildren and great-grandchildren.
He does.
That is older than his child just born.
Absolutely. He has a great-grandchild. In fact, he became a great-grandfather in 2014.
Okay, another annoying news. There was a Taman Tun water cut yesterday. How did this happen? I think to the consternation of a lot of residents, this was unannounced, unexpected.
Yeah. The water issue, and supply of water is a perennial problem in the state of Selangor. We had yesterday the former Menteri Besar Khalid Ibrahim speaking about it. We hope we can get somebody from the Selangor state government to come and tell us exactly how they're trying to manage this. Because, you know, when the water is cut off, it's like... You come close to the edge, right, in terms of civilization. People really go balmy when they don't have water.
Yeah, exactly. And Taman Tun is quite interesting because it's defined as Kuala Lumpur, but is still under the water management of the Selangor area, still under Shabazz. So they, you know, they would be under the mercy of Shabazz. So we hope that this will get sorted out soon. And in fact, any water cut is not forgivable, I guess.
Well, you know, look out there, Julian. It's pouring. So there's no lack of water. So if you're in Taman Tun and you don't have water coming through the taps, just step out into your garden and enjoy it all natural.
Okay, there you go. 6:16. We'll be back with more news. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9, 6:21 in the morning. You're with The Morning Run. We're going to have a very exciting lineup for you today. I'm Julian Ng, together with Rod Kutten. Now, do you know that four people have been selected for the 2016 Merdeka Award? And interestingly, one of them, pioneer filmmaker Lakshman Krishnan, who was among one of the four, and he's a filmmaker, in fact, having developed early talents like the very iconic P. Ramlee.
Yeah, you know, he is really, in some sense, the father of modern Malayan filmmaking, born in Madras but educated in Bukit Matajam. We're talking about before the Second World War. And, you know, he was with those filmmaking groups, Cathay Chris and the Shaw Brothers. They moved between them. He was a director. He's now in his 90s. And, you know, I remember him even 20 years ago when he was in, you know, in the media. He was he devoted quite a bit of his energies to helping people who'd spend time in prison get rehabilitated. So that became one of his passions after his retirement from film. But he really is the man who, in many ways, established Malayan and Malay cinema with, you know, his particular style.
I think I was watching on YouTube and a production by the History Channel, a documentary on P. Ramlee, and at the time, the filmmaking facilities were in Singapore, weren't they? And a lot of, actually, all Malay films were made out of the Singapore studios before they had to sever those ties and move them to Malaysia. And in the process also, which affected P. Ramlee's career, you know, it's such an interesting documentary, and it's available for free on YouTube. I think people should go and watch it.
You know, the other thing, Julian, if you have an interest in Malay films, Amir Mohammed's 101 Malay films is something, and the preface, as it were, the introductory chapter is really a tour de force, I mean, intellectually, and so easy to read, so much fun to read. But Amir Mohammed, you know, of course, himself a filmmaker and now, you know, well-known publisher, you know, makes very important points about early Malay cinema in terms of its thematic interests and how that has shifted over time. And it really stands as a serious critique of current filmmaking and also views of the establishment on film.
Are you going to put that on a tweet? I really want to...
Yeah, I'll see if I can find a link to Amir's book, but it's available in all good bookstores.
Okay.
So you can pick it up, but...
not a lousy one, but a good bookstore.
Well, you know, not all bookstores are created equal.
That's true. Definitely not all people, not all men are created equal, not all women are created equal. And the other three recipients, Pro-Chancellor of University Technology Malaysia, Dr. Salim Mohamad Noh, for the environment category, as well as Professor Dr. Lui Lai Ming for the health science and technology category, and Professor in the Faculty of Engineering and Built Environment of University Kebangsaan Malaysia, Professor Dr. Wan Ramlee Wan Daud, was selected for the Outstanding Scholastic Achievement category. So a lot of professors there, and probably rightly so. Now, there is also something in Japan, what I think is a sign of the times, Japan has come up not with a mascot, but an official emoji for the 2020 Olympics. And this comes in the shape of the onsen, which is a traditional Japanese hot spring bath. Absolutely delightful if you've tried it. But it's confusing to some people, especially in the Western world.
Okay, so I believe the confusion or the suggested confusion is that it looks like steam rising out of a bowl.
That's
so
right.
People might say, well, oh, this is a bowl of noodles. And I think, and I don't know why anybody would shy away from that, because I think the bowl of noodles, ramen, or...
It's equally iconic.
Yeah, it's iconic and it's comforting, you know.
Yeah.
This is brilliant installation work by a Vietnamese artist who creates a whole bedroom scene and a bed from instant noodles. And what he does is that the start of the day, he comes in, or every so often comes in, and he pours warm water on the noodles. And so when you walk into this room and you see the bedroom scene, you get the smell of instant noodles, you know. And this work by an artist whose name I cannot remember right now, it harkens to these very deep sentiments we have and attachments to smells like to instant noodles. I think anybody, when you smell that, think, comfort, you know.
Comfort and homeliness. I guess they don't want to appoint the bowl of ramen as an icon for the Olympics because perhaps they want to keep the diets of all the participants healthy, you know, with low-carb fat and paleo fat that's going on around the world. But, you know, have you tried the onsen, Sharad?
No, I actually, Jillian, I've only been to Japan once and in transit. So I've missed out on the Japanese experience. Though, you know, I know even in BFM, there are a lot of Japanophiles, people who are just flying off to Japan at the drop of a hat because you just love, if there's a holiday destination, it's no longer down under, it's up north somewhere.
Yeah. But it's really... very delightful, and another comforting item to add to your list, Sharad. It's basically water piped in from a natural hot spring into the comforts of your bathtub. And
these springs also, do they have like special minerals? Do they claim that?
Because
you can have a hot water bath, you know, right here in Petaling Jaya.
It's not quite the same.
Why? Why isn't it the same?
I don't know. You don't have all that... centuries, I guess, millennia of herbal brewing in the natural hot spring. But this is coming out of the pipe of Shabas in Petaling Jaya.
And not in Taman Tun, apparently.
Not in Taman Tun.
Not today. Not yesterday.
Some people actually cook the eggs in the onsen.
Oh, really?
And
together with themselves? I mean, surely it can't be that hot.
It's pretty hot. But there is this thing called the onsen egg. Recipe, and it also makes an excellent half-boiled egg because I think it's what they call the 63 degree egg or something like that. You go to some trendy restaurants and they serve that, right? And that's the onsen egg. It's just brewed at a particular temperature that keeps the egg white kind of soft and cooked, but the yolk liquid and nice and liquid. So it gives you a...
You're making me hungry, Julian.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, especially because eggs are such a breakfast food. Okay, so the solution to this problem of, you know, different cultural expectations or cultural frames and reading signs is that they're going to add little people under the steam, little strands of steam.
No, I think that was... Really? Are they going to do that? I thought that was a joke.
Was that a joke?
I don't know.
Oh, because that would look like a bowl of people being cooked.
In dipped in ramen, and that's not a good thing. But I think they should just leave it. Leave the mystery of it and make people ask questions and find out exactly what it is.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
I think
because that's the way in which you develop a conversation about a sign as opposed to something that it just says what it says and then because you kind of left there. Well, this would be, like you say, there's a bit of mystery around it and people can debate, you know. Otherwise, it might look like a bowl of people made out of little, you know, like little pasta people.
Exactly.
Like alphabet soup.
Yeah. And now for a person who will lift the shroud of mystery for us all is Lynn Mark with the news, BFM 89.9. It's 6:40. You're with Morning Run. I'm Julian Ng with Sharad Kutan. And that was Walk This Way by Aerosmith and Run DMC. Now, Amazon, that company we all should know by now, has introduced this thing called Amazon Go, which is a supermarket without cashiers. You grab and you go. And there was a video in the article that announced this news. And watching the video just evoked a sense of freedom because there is something so seamless and liberating in taking what you want and leaving. I think they might have gotten that idea from Uber, with that credit card payment, right? But this has also set the tongue, our tongues wagging about how the robots will take over.
Well, okay, even before the robots take over, I think this is a cynical move by shops. Cynical move. You know
really?
Why? Because those moments spent as you line up, to meet the cashier and to get your whatever you spent totaled up, is a moment for deep reflection about if you've overspent.
You are a fan of enforced boredom.
No. It could be. It's not enforced boredom. It's a chance to say to yourself, I really don't need that boutique, handmade ginger snaps or whatever it is. I can put that back and I don't have to buy it. So you're allowed to have a last think about what you've bought. And I think that...
You can do this with the system.
No, because you're saying that basically everything is kind of totaled up. Clearly, you'll have to link your credit card to the system and whatever.
Yeah, but
you just
put
your stuff in a bag
and you walk out. If you watch the video, you can take that thing, and if you change your mind, you can put it back, and it deducts from your
bill. Yes, but what I'm saying is that, yeah, so you do that anyway at shelves, but there is the last chance, right? So at the shelf, you might be putting things on, taking it out into your trolley, but when you are at the counter, when you're waiting, it is a moment where people, you'll see it. You see it in supermarkets. People decide, don't really want that.
I don't know if I buy into that because you're just saying that the system should remain inefficient and clunky just to help us
not overspend.
Just to help us deal with our own inadequacies.
Yeah, and why not? Shouldn't the system help us deal with our inadequacies?
I think the benefits outweigh the...
Maybe you're very sure of yourself when you go to the supermarket. I am one of those people, and I don't know how many of you out there go to supermarkets without a shopping list. I never managed to make myself a shopping list, and as a result, I'm thinking on the fly about what I want. I think, okay, do I really have this? Have I really bought it? The last time I came to the supermarket, did I get those cans of tomato paste?
I have a funny feeling that this is going to catch on like wildfire. And
of course it will, because corporations rule. And
I think it's what people want as well.
The scary thing, Julian, is we're going to be cash spending robots.
Don't always shift the blame to the corporations.
No, it's true. You know, you think it's about the you say the fear of robots, right? And the fact that all these jobs.
No, that's what I want to talk about.
All the jobs that are lost.
So let's never mind about that. Take the attention.
We'll be turned into robots.
Let's take the attention away from you for a moment, Sharad. And what do you think of these cashiers and all these other people who are going to lose their job as a result of the automation of the whole process?
Right. Okay. So the idea is, and I think this is the promise of robotics, is that everybody gets upskilled and we get more interesting jobs, the more creative jobs as a consequence. But that's just the promise. The reality, I think, is somewhat more mixed. And there will be a generation or a demographic or a segment in any society that's going to lose out as a consequence. I'm watching this discussion about Britain and unemployment in that country and the promise of free trade and liberalization. Great for young people. But when the politician says, makes promises, he's talking really to a younger demographic that are going to reap the benefits of globalization. What does he do? What does he say to that coal miner who's maybe in his 50s, who now no longer has a job and cannot be retrained to become an au pair or to work in a facility for old folks or, whatever it is, right, that are now the only jobs available? And what do you do? What do you say to that person about the benefits of globalization? I think this is one of the real conundrums about that, about the message about globalization or robotics or any of these things that harbingers of change, really.
I think a lot of the discussion centers around a universal income or life income as a form of solution to the robots taking over. But, I read an article from the New York Times from a few days ago, And this one is about it's called The Big Question. Is artificial intelligence, meaning robots, improving or taking over our lives? And they interviewed a few people, which I thought with some brilliant insights into how to frame the thinking behind the idea of robots taking over. And this guy called Neil Harrison, who's a British cyborg artist, whatever that is. He's an artist. And he says, I don't think machines will be interested in murdering and destroying us. That wouldn't be intelligent enough, right? And humans already know how to do that. So the way to deal with robots is to try to think like them, to try to think like technology. And in the process, you can think of how to make the world better. And this other guy, you might know him. His name is Garry Kasparov. He's one of the chess grandmasters. And today he's the chairman of the Human Rights Foundation and a former world champion. And he knows something about robots, right? Because 20 years ago, he played chess with the IBM computer, Deep Blue. And he has something to say. He said, we use machines to make new things, solve new problems, and create new industries that we can't yet imagine. The good news is that intelligent machines also liberate us from the tedious labor, letting us be more imaginative and ambitious. And he says that there is no choice but to push ahead and to just raise our ambitions as to how we can think about a better life with he calls it, we are being liberalized from hard labor. Once we are liberalized from hard labor, we have a time to think about our world.
Yeah, I think that liberation is real and I'm all for it. But I think there are other things that that robots won't be able to substitute. For instance, I was in the Mulu National Park earlier this year, and it was an extraordinary space because of the nature of the flora and fauna there, all of which could benefit from the sheer power, computing power that comes in monitoring. So you could monitor, I imagine, a whole forest just because the devices for monitoring things has become so so cheap and so available. So you could have it all over. It could be a great boon to protecting wildlife in the park. But the conversations I had with one of the guides who was a member of the Kenya community, but he was from the other side in Kalimantan from Indonesia, Indonesian national, spoke excellent English, a person who studied flora and fauna. And, so with the kind of conversations I had with him, I don't think a robot could have. So, for me, it's like, okay, there's some jobs that are going to be lost, some jobs that could not be done efficiently, they're going to be done extraordinarily well. Mm-hmm. But there's some things a human being, unless, of course, and of course I watch Westworld now. So, okay. Perhaps...
The other one to watch is also Black Mirror. I think it's all these lessons about a very dystopic future that can potentially happen if we're not careful. But just want to go back to Amazon's supermarket called the Amazon Go. Of course, when you go into supermarket, you think of food, and it's also coming to the end of the year, and this is when you come up with lists, right, of what happened in the year. There's this thing called the most popular food hacks of 2016. Give you a few very surprising anecdotes about food. For example, it doesn't matter when you eat. So forget about the breakfast being the most important meal of the day. Forget about this rule that you cannot eat about 4 hours before you go to bed.
What basis do they make this
research,
kind of claims?
Research is based on research.
I don't see any footnotes in this piece.
click on the link and you'll see it.
Okay.
You don't need to boil your pasta. That's one food hack for you.
Yeah, you first boil the water and
You can put the pasta in there and it will turn out okay. Yeah.
But you have to keep it in for a longer period, I imagine.
8 minutes is what they put on the label, the plastic bag that comes
out.
Oh,
I see. Okay.
Do you cook a lot?
I do. In fact, today I brought chicken a la tomato.
It was supposed
to be a chicken curry, but it became so tomatoey. My friend complains, where's the curry in this chicken? But some people are just used to, I am Mr. Unconventional when it comes to the kitchen, Julian. Perhaps because I don't work with the recipe.
Yeah, I think that's a common complaint in life. You can say that there is not enough curry, right? That's always our... our major complaint. That's never enough curry.
I don't know about that.
Okay, we're going to be coming back with the top business conversations after the 7 a.m. news. And in the meantime, here's Everyday People by Sly and the Family Stone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.